Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Noir on the Radio, presented by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm your executive producer, Pam Stack, and I'm very pleased to welcome your special guest for tonight, Ed Imar. Ed is the author of I'll Sleep When You're Dead, which was published in 2013, and You're As Good As Dead, published in 2015. Both are published by Opal Books. He also writes a monthly column in the Washington Independent Review of Books and is the managing editor of The Thrill Begins for the ITW. It is my pleasure to introduce to you right now your host for this evening's Flash Fiction Throwdown, Ed Imar. Ed, welcome. How are you? Ed, are you there? Ed, are you there? Okay, I guess he's still coming live. Okay. Ed, you there? Ed? Hello, Ed. Okay, we're trying to get everybody live. It's a little bit difficult. We have 10 authors on right now, so just waiting to bring Ed Imar into the studio. Ed, are you with us yet? Hello? Ed? Ed, are you there? That's interesting. I don't know where he is. Okay, let me see. Let me go to the first person who's supposed to be with us. Can everybody else hear me? Hello?
Loud. I hear you.
Hi, I hear you. Okay. I hear you.
Everybody's there. Okay, everybody but Ed can hear me. That's not a good thing. So I tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to go ahead and get started. I do not know all the bios of our guests, but I'm going to go to our first guest. Tara, are you there?
I am.
Hi. Give everybody your full name, please.
Sure. I'm Tara Laskowski, and I'm a writer.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I'm a writer. I live in Northern Virginia, and I have a short story collection called Bystanders, which is coming out in May of this year. And I was actually going to read an opening scene from one of the stories in that collection.
Okay. And how long have you been writing?
Many years.
Many years. Okay. What is the name of the story that you're going to be reading?
The story is called There's Someone Behind You. And I'm just going to read the opening scene from it.
Okay. Well, we'll let you go ahead and do that then.
All right. They park on the side of a dark road in front of an old railroad bridge overtaken by weeds. This is your surprise? Ruthie asks, her smile fading as William shuts off the car. Come on, it'll be fun. Ruthie shakes her head. I'm not getting out of the car. Where the hell are we? We're in my old neighborhood. I know exactly where we are. William, I swear to God, if you're trying to scare me. Ruthie trails off, examining the bridge. The concrete has crumpled in places, and there are hints of faded graffiti, giving it the feel of a Roman ruin meets abandoned bus depot. Ruthie reluctantly gets out of the car, crossing her arms in front of her chest. It is mid-October, but Virginia is going through a heat wave, and William is wearing cargo shorts and a T-shirt that make him look very undentist-like. She is worried he is going through a midlife crisis, and she's part of the plan, the blonde mistress almost half his age. He comes to her and drapes his arm across her shoulders. They walk along the side of the road, Ruthie's heels catching on pebbles and stones. The bridge is a concrete arch built into a hill. The road passes through the hill under the arch, creating a narrow one-lane tunnel, and then curves sharply to the right directly under the bridge. Come on, we have to get to the top, William says. She lets him help her, complaining the whole way. It is dark and she is too old for this shit. And yet these kinds of stunts were, in part, why she had been attracted to him in the first place. He was much more fun than any other man his age. Sometimes he just went too far. At the top of the railroad bridge, Ruthie and William stand directly over the road and look down at his lonely car. They are only a few miles from Washington, D.C., but out here it feels like the middle of nowhere. She shivers. I'll tell you what this is, he says, lowering his voice in a way that makes Ruthie feel like throwing him over the bridge. It's called the Bunnyman Bridge. Years ago, a bus was transporting a bunch of inmates from an insane asylum over to Lorton Prison. Fuck you, William. You said you weren't going to scare me. She punches him in the shoulder. Shh. He puts his finger on her lips, and in spite of herself, she bites it playfully. He continues. Anyway, the bus crashed, and a bunch of the patients escaped and ran into these woods. The police caught all of them except this one guy. They started finding dead bunny bodies all around here and figured he was surviving on the meat. Then one night they finally surrounded him, and you know he's all crazy. And just as they're about to get him, he jumps in front of an approaching train and kills himself. Ruthie kicks him in the shoe. She's not scared, really, just a little confused by his definition of entertainment. She's still waiting for the punchline. She moves closer to him and looks up, thrilled more at the nice way his eyes shine in the moonlight than by the silly story he's telling. She likes when he teases her. She also likes to always be touching him as if to prove to herself he's really there. So this place is haunted? He supposedly comes back every year and kills someone on Halloween. Great. Great story. Thanks. He snorts. You're no fun. She glares at him. So what? You were bringing me here hoping to get lucky? She puts her arms around his neck and presses her body into his. He laughs. I forgot you were easy. Ruthie pulls away. Whatever. She leans over the concrete ledge and looks down at the dark road below. So did you bring your wife here to make out? William grabs her at the waist. His shoes scuff on the dirt. Here, ghosty, ghosty, he whispers into her ear. It annoys her when he chooses to ignore questions about his wife, even though she knows, they both know, that there's no way to answer them without trouble. William pulls away, his eyes bright from the moon. His face changes. I think there's someone behind you there in the woods. Watch out. You're a jerk. She begins the descent herself, eager to get back to the car. She can hear William behind her, and then he stops, and she looks back, balancing herself. His behavior irritates her, especially in moments like these when she sees him for what he really is, a middle-aged man favoring his knee. Did you hear that? His face is hard to make out, and Ruthie grows angry. Shut up, William. Act your age for once. It sounded like whispering. It sounded like Ruthie. That's all.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Ed, do we have you on the line yet?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Very good. Sorry, we don't know what happened to you. Thank you so much, Tara. That was terrific.
Of
I'm going to let Ed take over now. And you're on, Ed.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me, Pam. And sorry about that. Sorry that I missed the opening. Did you guys already go through the lineup of readers tonight?
Nope, just started
okay.
off with Tara because I
with
didn't
Tara.
Know what you had going on. So I'm going to turn it over to you now,
gotcha.
And you go ahead and get going, all right?
All right, thanks again for having us here. You guys just heard Tara Lukowski, and next up we have Alan Orloff. After him we'll have Josh Pachter, Meredith Cole, Steve Weddle, Dana King, Meg Opperman, Nick Corpon, and Art Taylor. As Pam said, my name is Ed Amar, and I'll be your host, and... potentially, unless I get cut off again. Our plan tonight is to do the readings, with each one lasting about 5 minutes, then we'll have time for calls and questions at the end. Our next reader is Alan Orloff. Alan's debut mystery, Diamonds for the Dead, was an Agatha Award finalist, and his most recent novel, Running from the Past, was a winner in Amazon's Kindle Scout program. His short fiction has appeared or will appear in Needle, Shotgun Honey, Jewish Noir, Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, and Chesapeake Crime's Storm Warning. Alan lives in Northern Virginia, teaches fiction writing at the Writers Center in Bethesda, and is currently pantsless. Alan Orloff.
Thank you, Ed. I'm wearing pants. They're just sweatpants. Okay, I'm reading a short piece of flash fiction, and it's called Seeing the Light. Too tiny Tino kept his eyelids pressed together, shielding himself against the bright flashlight inches from his face. Now sitting in a folding chair with hands and feet tied, he'd been interrogated for the last 3 hours by Salazar and his lieutenants, and Tino had been slowly cracking, giving up more and more information about his peeps, the Hightown boys. The light withdrew, and Tino eased his eyes open in time to see Salazar lean forward. "Where's your hangout?" The gang leader's hot breath reeked of garlic. "I told you, I don't know." Salazar tapped on Tino's forehead with the head of a ball-peen hammer, not nearly as hard as when he'd taken a few whacks at Tino's kneecap 20 minutes earlier. Or had that been 2 hours ago? "I thought we'd established the rules here. I ask, you answer." A couple of Salazar's gangsters snickered in the background. "Do we need to get out the pruning shears again?" Tino had been trimmed down to 8 fingers. Lucky for him, pinkies weren't essential. Yet he hadn't given Salazar the bit of information he really wanted, the location of the boys' home base. They'd need to do more damage before he rolled over. The info had to be earned. "Whatever you need to do, but I don't know where they're at, not now anyway. We move around, you know?" Tino spit out some blood and a few drops found Salazar's face. Salazar swung the hammer in a vicious arc, smashing Tino's right elbow. Tino gasped, and the room shimmied before him like heat rising from the asphalt, but he didn't pass out, this time. A few moments later, the world regained its focus, and he was able to squeeze out an answer. "Okay, okay, they're on the west side of Hennepin Avenue, past the 7-Eleven. "Not so tough now, huh?" Salazar laughed. "We're making progress, but we're not there yet, are we? I need to know exactly where they are, like an address, bro." He swung the hammer again, finding the exact same spot on Tino's elbow. This time, the stars in Tino's eyes twinkled a little brighter than before and lasted longer. Tino sucked in a few quick breaths. He lived hard during his 19 years, enduring tough times, often just scraping to get by. He'd been overlooked by his teachers, his uncles, his neighbors. Rich and poor, young and old, no one ever paid much attention to the puny kid with the spindly arms and pronounced limp. He'd watched more friends die than he could count. Of course, sometimes you had to take one for the team. Salazar patted him on his cheek. "Still there, big man, or have you checked out for good?" Tino grunted. He'd been prepared to die, expecting to die, really, since he joined the boys when he was 14, after he'd capped a guy to prove he belonged. "Okay, enough bullshit." Salazar tossed the hammer aside, pulled out a gun, and held it flush against Tino's forehead. "Last chance. Give it up, or you'll know about dying firsthand. Or should I say, first head?" Salazar's buddy snorted while Tino's insignificant existence flashed before his eyes. One last chance to give his life meaning. He'd held off Salazar long enough. It was his time to shine. His boys would have their ambush set by now, ready to wreck Salazar and his gang. All Tino needed to do was give up their location and let his homies exact revenge. He exhaled dramatically, one last bit of acting before his final curtain call. "Okay, okay. They're in the basement of the old terrace apartments, in a room next to the laundry machines. The back door sticks, but it ain't always locked." "Thanks, amigo. I knew we could count on you." A smug smile grew on Salazar's face, and Tino swelled with pride. The asshole didn't suspect a thing, making victory that much sweeter. Tino wished he'd be around to celebrate with his posse, but that wouldn't happen. Not in this life. As Salazar's finger tightened on the trigger, Tino closed his eyes again, the irrelevant runt, finally at peace, and braced for the blaze of Hell's Inferno.
All right, nicely done.
Terrific.
So, like I said, we're going to do questions and calls from listeners at the end of the readings, probably about a quarter till. But I want to ask a couple of questions to each writer after they're done. Alan, that's a great piece. Is that part of a longer story or?
No, it's a standalone piece of flash fiction.
So how did you determine where to start it?
Well, you know, you start in the middle of the action, so I figured I'd start right where he was getting interrogated and take it from there.
Oh,
with flash fiction,
nicely.
Of course, you don't have much time to do a lot of setup.
Yeah. Oh, nicely done. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Our next reader tonight is Josh Pachter. Josh Pachter's short crime fiction has appeared in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine since the late 1960s. He's the second youngest writer ever to sell to Ellery Queen and one of a small handful who contributed new fiction to its pages in 6 consecutive decades. He's had 2 books out. He has 2 books out, a collection of short stories titled The Tree of Life and a novel called Styx. He also translates fiction and nonfiction from Dutch to English and has edited 8 anthologies for U.S. and European publishers. A native New Yorker, Josh now lives in Virginia, where he's the Assistant Dean for Communication Studies and Theater at Northern Virginia Community College. He recently had surgery and is currently filled with more painkillers and Rush Limbaugh at a Planned Parenthood endorsement rally for Hillary Clinton. Josh Factor.
Hi. Yeah, you got it right about the painkillers. Most of the other stuff, too. So I'm going to read a scene from Styx, which is a novel that I wrote with Belgian author Bavo Doha. The main character is Raphael Styx, who's a corrupt cop in the city of Ostend, Belgium, which is right now being terrorized by a serial killer. The local press have nicknamed the Stuffer. And in this scene, Styx, who has caught the Stuffer but himself been shot 3 times in the heart and killed, has come back as a zombie to continue the investigation. And here he goes to see a small-time gangster named Gino Tersago. Gino Tersago was struck dumb. He quaked with terror, stared into the blighted eyes, the ruined face that steamed with miasmal vapors. "Styx," he croaked at last. "I heard you was dead." "Don't believe everything you hear," said Raphael Styx. There was so much for the two of them to talk about, the deals, the bribes, corruption, but there was a problem. Styx's hunger was getting worse. He was so achingly hungry. "Well, what the fuck happened?" said Tersago. "You're not dead." "It's none of your business, Terry." And then the most incredible thing Styx had experienced since dying occurred. As if Gino Tersago dealt with stinking, moldering gargoyles every night of his life, he seemed satisfied with Styx's non-answer. "Okay, by me," he said. "I got my own problems. I don't know where you've been these last days, but I could have used you around here." Styx was stunned. "I'm sorry my personal situation interfered with your plans," he said. "What interfered? You think you can't be replaced, Styxy? Trust me, nobody's irreplaceable. But your fucking guys almost nabbed me. Some cop got wind of what was going down, and if I was stupid as he thought I was, I would have walked right smack into a trap." "What happened?" "I must have some kind of sixth sense. I just felt like something wasn't kosher, so I blew off the deal in the nick of time. That didn't make me too popular with my business associates, though." He tugged at his upper lip with his bottom teeth. "And that's your fault, Styxy, for not being here when I needed you." "Shucks," Styx said, fake humbly. Deep inside, it was bizarrely nice to think that someone still claimed to need him. "I mean, what do you think I was doing with Tweedledum and Tweedledumma just now, playing charades? Those guys don't speak Flemish, Dutch, English, French, nothing. You don't talk commie, do you? Maybe you can explain them the fuck up was your fault, not mine." "I told you I was changing my ways, Terry." "Not exactly a change for the better, the way you look, you freak." It disappointed Styx that Tersago didn't seem to give a damn why he was still alive and what had happened to him. How self-centered could the guy be? "You think I'm not on to you?" the gangster continued. "You got everybody thinking the fucker Stuffer took you down, but you just been hiding out from him, you coward. Is that why I ain't seen you? You know that schmuck Krevitz give me the 3rd degree for like 2 hours? He thought I was the fucking Stuffer." "You still don't understand," Styx said, "do you?" "I ought to beat the crap out of you just for that, Styx. You got any idea what it's like to spend 2 hours cooped up with a sweat bucket like that Krevitz?" "You don't understand," Styx repeated slowly. "Don't understand what?" "This," said Styx, "me. I'm real, Terry. This is not a game." "What, real you? You're not real, man. You're a fucking joke." I don't hear anyone laughing. Tersago turned away looking for his associates, but they had fled. He returned his attention to Styx. You telling me you're really dead? You expect me to believe that shit? Styx took a step closer and leaned in as far as his aching hip allowed. You want proof, Terry? He whispered. Trisago pulled back. Jesus, you go to hell, buddy. I just came from there, said Styx. And without any warning, he lunged forward and bit off the gangster's ear. Trisago screamed, but Styx grabbed him with both arms and raked the side of his head with his teeth, gouging down to the bone. He tasted flesh and blood and heard Trisago shrieking in a voice that was no longer human. Jesus fucking Christ! Get him the fuck off me! But there was no one left there to help him. Styx wrestled the gangster out of his chair and fell on top of him, gnawing greedily at his cheeks and nose and chin until his ravenous hunger was finally stilled. Gino Trisago twitched spastically on the floor, not quite dead. Blood poured from 100 face wounds. Styx got to his knees, panting. The floorboards were drenched with blood. What do you say, Terry? He gasped. You believe me now?
Nicely done.
Wow, that was a great story.
Thank you.
So, Josh, you when you wrote this, you translated it, but you also co-wrote it, correct?
Yeah. Bavo wrote a first draft in Dutch, and his American agent, who knew me from some other projects, felt that the book needed more than just a straight translation. It also needed more of an Americanized slant for the American market. So Bavo and Peter, the agent, came to me and asked me if I'd get involved in the project, and Bavo and I worked all the way through it together, making some changes and turning the book into an English manuscript, which Simon & Schuster published in November.
Yeah, did you guys correspond electronically, or did you ever meet in person?
Well, while we were working on the book, everything happened via email. We were back and forth 5 or 6 times a day. But since we finished, Bavo and I have spent quite a bit of time together, both this past summer and also the summer before. I visited him both years at his home in Ghent in Belgium. Great guy. Terrific writer. Next year we'll see the publication of his 100th novel in Belgium.
And for 100 novels, I know the answer to this, but I think listeners will like it too. What's the length of time for those 100 novels?
His first book came out in 2001.
What an asshole.
I know you mean that in the nicest possible way.
I mean it in a very nice way. Yeah, that's terrific. All right, thank you, Josh.
Sure.
So our next reader tonight needs no introduction.
So you're not going to introduce?
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. Tonight's next reader is Meredith Cole. Meredith was the winner of the St. Martin's Press Malice Domestic Competition, and her first book, Posed for Murder, was nominated for an Agatha Award for Best First Mystery Novel. Her second book, Dead in the Water, continued the adventures of photographer Lydia McKenzie in Brooklyn. Her short stories have appeared in the anthologies Murder New York Style and Virginia's for Mystery, as well as Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. She teaches writing at the University of Virginia. Meredith Cole.
Thanks. No fictional flourishes on that one. I have a flash fiction piece called This Job is Murder. So I'll just start. One of the hardest things about being a hitman is keeping my job a secret from everyone, especially my girlfriend. Caitlin is a vegan, spider-hugging, Buddhist, aspiring yoga teacher, and she definitely wouldn't approve. We met at the coffee shop where she works as a barista 3 months ago. I told her I was an insurance salesman, which was just boring enough to discourage any question. I haven't hung out with her as much as I would have liked lately because I had a rush of mob hits, mostly Castucci's and Marizano's, keeping me busy, a real growth industry. Kill one and the other family wanted revenge killing and so on. They all liked to use me because I was clean, discreet, and I never repeated myself. The way I see it, every hit is different and requires finesse, and it's harder for them to catch you when you don't have a signature style. To make up for my neglect, I invite Caitlin along for a business trip to San Francisco. I figure she could do a spa and yoga retreat while I take care of one of the Castuccis. Once I deposit Caitlin at the hotel, I get right to work shadowing Marcello Castucci. His life is pretty dull. He goes for breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day to a greasy spoon a block from my hotel called Benny's. If I wasn't in a hurry, I would just wait for him to have a heart attack. But he has to be dead by Thursday or I don't get paid. I change into black pants and a white shirt and knock on the back door of Benny's. The cook, a tall, skinny guy, opens the door. I'm looking for a job, I say. We have an opening for a busboy. Busboys bring water and food and the chance to get close to Marcello. Sure, I say. I've done it before. He looks at my fake passport so quickly I can tell he's used to hiring illegals. He introduces me to the waitresses Pat and Dot, who have identical short frosted hair and pink uniforms, and puts me to work on a mound of dirty dishes. Around lunchtime, Marcello comes in with his bodyguards. Dot and Pat are busy, so he flags me down. A soda, he demands. If he'd said please, I might have felt guilty about bumping him off. His goons want coffee, and they don't have great manners either. As I head back to the kitchen, I spot Caitlin settling into a booth. My heart stops for a moment, but I keep moving, hoping she doesn't see me. The cook has his back to me, sweating over the grill as I pour the soda. A month ago, I killed another mob guy with poison in his drink. I don't want to repeat myself, but I'm in a hurry and anxious to get out of here. I drop a cyanide capsule into Marcella's soda. Plop. Easy. I pour the coffee, load all the drinks onto a tray, and carry it slowly back to the table. I give him his soda and the bodyguards their coffee. None of them says thank you, of course. Marcella takes a big gulp. Keeping my back to Caitlin, I start to clear a table nearby. I hear a choking noise behind me. His face is an alarming shade of red, and he's clawing at his throat. The goons jump up and pound him on the back. I hurry back to the kitchen, pretending that I'm getting help. The cook is already calling 911 when I rush in. A few minutes later, the EMTs arrive with a stretcher. Everyone watches silently as they try to revive him. Only I know for sure that it will do no good. In the confusion, I scoop up the cups and glasses. When the cops come, I don't want there to be any evidence. The cook comes into the kitchen as I'm washing the last load. We're going to shut down for a couple of days. I'm sorry, but I can't pay you to sit around and not work. I try to look down about getting let go, but I thank him after he counts out my pay in greasy fives and tens. When I walk out the back door, I'm surprised to find Caitlin waiting for me. She looks at me different, her eyes sharp and squinty. I guess I never did ask what kind of insurance you sell. I'm a hitman, I tell her. I'm going to miss Caitlin. The only way to keep her quiet is to kill her. My sweating hands open and close as I imagine them squeezing her long, pale throat. Suddenly, Caitlin has a gun in her hand, pointed at my chest. I blink once, twice, but the gun is still there. Babe, I'd never hurt you. Really? Caitlin says, tossing her hair back. Even though Tony Marizano was my brother? Oh, I put a bullet in Tony Marizano's brain last August. Caitlin played me as easy as I play my victims. I've lost my touch. But you're a Buddhist. You can't kill anyone, I say. Not at all confident anymore. If she's in the mob, she could kill a puppy without blinking. Caitlin shrugs. There are way too many people on the planet already. It's not like they're going extinct. I hear the shot and feel a searing pain as I fall forward onto the pavement. I always was afraid that I would end up like this, face down, dead in an alley. I just never imagined that the one who killed me would be the woman I loved, and it would be all my fault for ignoring my own advice. Never, ever repeat yourself.
Nicely done, Meredith. Great story.
Thank you.
So, I've read a bit of your work, and that seems like a bit of a departure, right? I mean, to have a straight, you know, cold, calculating killer.
Yeah, I thought it was a lot of fun. I mean, I think for me, writing short stories is a chance to try something different that I'm not sure if I could sustain in a novel. I was really interested in playing with contrast, you know, the vegan girlfriend and the hitman, and he's trying to keep it a secret. And then just, you know, I think what really often works in stories is a twist. So trying to twist and then twist again. So It was a lot of fun. It was fun to cut this down. It was a longer story to cut this down for 5 minutes. It was a lot of fun to do.
Do you think it helped cutting it down, or do you prefer the longer version?
I think editing always helps. you know, maybe I'm alone here on the phone about that, but I often feel that even when I'm forced to cut something down, it is always better in the end.
Gotcha.
Yeah, but maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm very, you know, I write too much.
All right. Thanks, Meredith. Our next writer up is facial hair enthusiast Steve Weddle. Steve grew up on the Louisiana-Arkansas line, holds an MFA in creative writing from Louisiana State University, and currently works for a newspaper group. He teaches writing for Lit Reactor, blogs that do some damage, and edits Needle, a magazine of noir. His debut novel, Country Hardball, was published in North America by Tyrus Books. The follow-up to Country Hardball, South of Bradley, recently appeared in Playboy magazine. Steve Weddle.
This is the opening to the new book I'm working on. So this is how it starts. The TV screen was split horizontally. On the top, Cameron worked her way along ledges, reaching across rooftops and unbalancing ski masked men to their deaths. Throat split, cartwheeling towards gravity 20 stories below. She moved through an open window and used a key card to open a soldier-filled room. Silently, backstabbing, catching and lowering bodies to the floor. Cameron had been chosen, selected, trusted with a mission to prevent the complete destruction of Kazakhstan, prevent the next world war. On the bottom half of the TV, Danny English was crouching until his head burst into a Jackson Pollock, at which point Respawn appeared, followed by more spastic crouching, the exploding head, the respawning. Once, he had made it out of the alley and into the street, up the front steps of the building, before he somehow set off all his frag grenades in his own pocket. Another time, he'd been able to hide near a sports car, kneeling behind it until he'd been dripping off of it, a shattering blast while he was looking for the Y button. Which button is the grenade? He asked the 10-year-old on the sofa to his right. Grenade is L2. Thought that was the scope. No, that's in a sniper build. You don't have that loadout now, Cameron said, pulling a tuxedoed man in front of her to catch the bullets, then firing across the man's shoulder until the room was clear and a tiny green box appeared above a distant door. I thought you were a soldier, she said when she'd gotten to the door. Good Lord, why would you say that? Well, that's what Mom said, that you were a soldier. Danny smirked, shook his head. Then, as his character fell from what Danny had thought was ground level, well, he died laughing. Kiddo, do I look like a soldier to you? He pointed his controller to the screen. Cameron looked at Danny closely now, the basement light flattening through a small window behind, the recessed bulb overhead offering a cool 40-watt glow. Stand up, please, Cameron said, as the game's pause screen came up. Not quite 6 feet tall, 160 pounds, maybe 65 if we're being honest. Not skinny, not fat. Pretty standard build, Cameron said. Is that a compliment? No. It's what you'd start with if you didn't know what you were doing. Like if you didn't know anything about the game when you started, like if you didn't have a goal. All right, didn't know anything, no goal. You know, like if I didn't know whether I wanted a sniper class or melee or whatever, and I just wanted to start playing without thinking about it. Most people, they decide what class they want to be first. Like, I'm playing Alex Kingkiller. She's stealth, so she has to have good agility and good perception. If you want a melee character, you'd want to put your points on strength. It's really not that complicated. That's a good explanation, Danny said. See, you're like the basic build, where you spread your points around all even. I'll take that as a compliment. Cameron turned back to the game. You shouldn't.
Thank you, Steve. Nicely done. So you said that's the part of your new book?
Yeah, I figured it needed an opening because the guy's going to IRL, as the kids say, be quite the feisty little killer. So it was important to me as someone who has gotten his ass kicked at a number of Call of Duty and Fallout games that we sort of use that as that experience and get something out of it other than just my shame.
So did you is this book, is it going to continue Country Hardball, or is it going to be
Country Hardball, I went a little forward, and that's the story that appeared in Playboy, and
right.
then because it makes completely no sense to do so, I decided to go back and write a novel set in 1933 that takes place in the same Country Hardball area with some of those families earlier. So I'm finishing up that novel. And so as I finish that up and get back to the edits, I wanted to start something new and completely different. I thought it would be nice if I wrote a book in present day so that I didn't have to spend 9 out of every 10 hours researching what the hell happened in 1933 Arkansas.
Has the change kind of been inspiring? You know, to change from historical fiction to the contemporary?
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, you know, a lot of people who start books, even the non-writers, you know, when they start books, they find that they have there's a lot of momentum going for the first 10,000 words or so. You realize how much work it is. So, you know, we'll see how much idea is left after a while. But right now, we got a heck of a lot of momentum.
Very cool. Sounds great. Thank you, Steve. And now I know that Pam has we'll take a short break for Pam.
Hi, thank you. Gosh, you have some really good guests lined up tonight, Ed. Congratulations. I want to remind everyone that you're listening to Noir on the Air. This is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. We have a few more guests to come still, Dana King, Meg Opperman, Nick Carpone, and Art Taylor, and then we're going to hear again from Ed. But in the meantime, if you want to speak to one of the authors or the host, please take down this number. It's 347-633-9609. That's 347-633-9609. And when the final author reads their piece, Ed will go ahead and ask for callers. And you're welcome to call in and speak to any or one of the authors. Thanks, Ed. Back to you.
Sure. When not frantically deleting porn from his computer before his wife gets home, our next writer, Dana King, runs the popular blog One Bite at a Time. Dana's first novel featuring detective Nick Forte, A Small Sacrifice, received the Seamus Award nomination in 2013, and Woody Hott named his book Grime Joint one of the best 15 noir reads of 2013. His short fictions appeared in the anthology Blood, Guts, and Whiskey, Spine Tingler, New Mystery Reader, Twist of Noir, Hysterical Lee, and Powder Burn Flash. Dana King.
Thank you, Ed. The story I'm going to read tonight is called A 21st Century Hero. It grew out of a discussion I had on a website once where people were talking about that all heroes needed to be flawed, and according to some of them, they couldn't be flawed enough. So I thought I would take a shot to see how flawed I could make one. My mouth tasted like a dirty sock. The clock on the wall showed 11:30. Insufficient information. I pulled back a curtain. Sunlight blinded me. A.M. then. Not bad after last night. An empty bottle of Jack Daniels skidded across the floor when I stood. Another on the coffee table. One of those was over half empty when I started. No wonder I was up early. I shuffled to the bathroom. My head felt like Laurence Olivier was drilling into my safe. Someone had lipstick a note on the mirror. You're an asshole. Could be Carol. Christy. They were both last night. Only one of them was supposed to be. The other was pretty pissed when she found us together. Carol, I think. Or Christy. Probably Carol. Christy dots her eyes a little. No eyes in the mess. Could call them both if I really wanted to know. Or I could play it safe and call Michelle. I did a couple of lines off the toilet lid and brushed my teeth with the residue to clear my head. I had to go to my old man's place. I hated him ever since the first time he crawled into bed with me to make sure I wasn't cold. I was 9, it was July. I avoided him when I could, but he said he had some of my money. He'd want something, sure, but an asshole's money spends like anyone else's. I found him in the kitchen. Blood and brains covered his face. One look and I was back in the jungle. Choppers overhead. Death car and Wagner and the smell of napalm in the morning. First flashback I'd had in over a year. Thanks, Dad. How much I could do for him with brain on his face. He'd said there was money and knew better than to lie to me. I searched the place. Nothing but change. I gave it up what booze he had and snagged the plastic ring of his pack with my finger. Didn't worry about Prince. I was his loving son. Could have been there any time. Besides, whichever chick didn't leave the note would alibi me. Walking out, I saw a baseball hat on the kitchen table. Big-ass fans. It was some jock's autograph. I found Whitey Purcell in Fat Jimmy's Lounge buying drinks with a good-sized roll. Strolled over and sat next to him. Buy me a drink. Buy you a drink. I don't like you any better than I like your old man. Yeah, but you ain't dick-faced killed me yet. My Tourette's acted up sometimes when I was stressed. Or drinking. Or using drugs or not taking the medication. Whitey turned the color of his name. Looked straight ahead. What are you talking about? Where is that hat you cocksucker like so much, Whitey? A big-ass shit fan? His hand touched his head before he could stop himself. It got dirty. I threw it out. No, you didn't. You forgot it at my old man. How much you needle dick take off it? Whitey stared into his beer. How much do you want? All of it. He took the roll from his shirt pocket, laid it on the bar with his hand over it. What does this buy me? You were with me, all liquor, when they ask you about the hat. I gestured to the bartender for another round for Whitey and the same for me. You think they'll suspect you if the grieving son is seen drinking with you all day and gives you a psychic alibi? The old bastard owed us both. The bartender brought us each a bump and a beer. I lifted my shot glass to Whitey. Drink up, buddy.
Thank you, Dana. I love the first line of that story. My mouth tasted like a dirty sock. It's a great image. And weirdly, I think we've all been there. How? So, what kind of, you know, to get the Tourette's in the story? What kind of, you know, was that difficult?
No, I just started, and well, I hadn't done anything really silly with this guy for a while. What could I do? And I thought, well, I could put some gratuitous foul language in her with Tourette's, and that's what I did.
And is this part of, like you said, you know, is this part of a longer piece, or?
No, that's it. That's the whole thing. That was, what happened was I got into an argument with somebody on the Crime Space website, and she thought no character, no protagonist was believable unless he was damaged. And we went back and forth and began to talk to her. They couldn't be damaged enough. So I kind of got a bug up my ass and thought, okay, how bad could I make this guy? So this is what I came up with.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next up is Meg Opperman. Meg has had short stories published in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, Sherlock Holmes Mystery Magazine, Weird Tales, and Chesapeake Crimes, Homicidal Holidays. She also writes a monthly column for the Washington Independent Review of Books. A cultural anthropologist by training, Meg has spent significant time studying the remote and wild lands of suburban Maryland. Meg Opperman.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. My story is called Surf's Up, and it's actually the first piece of, I guess you'd call it flash. It's a little long, but basically flash fiction. So, surf's up. Hey, you, kid, you can't park your board here. I glared at the teenage punk, longboard tucked under his skinny arm as he trudged through the sand toward the water, our beach. There were other beaches further north where they'd accepted anyone. This wasn't those beaches. Of course, the other beaches didn't have the A-frame wave we did. But that was only because we blocked every effort of local government to institute measures for erosion control. Totally ruined the waves. Phil and Steve flanked me as we moved in. A dose of intimidation should have the little beaner running for home, or at least a taco shop down the street. What? The kid stopped, swept her hand through long black bangs. You heard me. Move along. You don't like strangers, especially your kind. His eyes widened. If not for that, I wouldn't have noticed. His irises weren't the usual mud brown, but a startling violet. Don't even get me started about Mexicans mixing with the rest of us. Guess that's one way to get a green card. This isn't a private beach. His back straightened and his knuckles whitened where they held the board. Ballsy kid, I'll give him that. Yeah, it kind of is. See, my friends and I have been surfing it for more than 30 years, and the Bayside Buds don't just let anybody have a paddle. Still not a private beach. I'm just here to ride my sled in peace, man. His voice cracked as he said it, but he actually put his back to us and continued toward our surf, not in this lifetime. I nodded to Phil and Steve, and we hurried around him to form a wall between us and the waves. I poked the little hombre, son of a mass. Need to leave, amigo. He rubbed his chest where I'd struck, his face a mask of disbelief. Whatever. You old carp don't need to get your tighty-whities in a bunch. And he walked around us again like we weren't even there. This meant more. A longer campaign than we anticipated, I'll admit. Phil managed to trip the kid more than once as he came from the surf, and Steve and I repeatedly snowballed him, making the waves break before their time. He wouldn't get a good run if we had anything to say about it. When Frank and Rich showed up, they joined in taunting him and laughing whenever he'd take gas or his takeoff was too slow. Finally, after several hours and one nasty spin-out, oh, God, the kid had enough and packed it in. We trailed him to a beat-up minivan and watched him strap his board to the top. Instead of surfing bumper stickers, the van was littered with Camp Pendleton logos. What a waste. As the kid put pedal to the metal, he shot us the bird. Kids these days, Bill shook his head. I couldn't agree more. Imagine my surprise when the kid pulled up in his minivan the next weekend. He climbed out, unstrapped his board like he belonged, only he didn't. This is going to take a more direct approach, I muttered. After a call into the guys, I watched as the kid paddled into the waves, not bothering to stand up. Dick dragging, might as well bodyboard. Within 15 minutes, a couple of Hummers, two Land Rovers, and a Prius, Captain Phil, just had to be different, pulled up. Reinforcements had arrived. Let's see how he liked getting fin chopped. Steve excelled at that move, and several of us made it our mission to paddle battle him for the waves. After a particularly nasty fin chop, the kid got worked hard, and when he came up from the surf, his face was all scraped up. Ooh, that had to hurt. I ran my shoulder into him as he passed, and he fell on his ass. The guys laughed. You know, I can call the cops if you keep harassing me. We all laughed harder. You do that, hombre. And while you're at it, you should tell the sheriff to arrest the mayor's brother-in-law. I pointed to Frank, who gave a middle finger salute. And to councilman Andrews, I indicated Rich. I swear the kid's lip trembled, and those weird eyes blinked back tears, but the little beaner turned back into the surf. What the hell? What was it going to take to convince this kid to move along? Another hour of harassment did the trick. He practically ran to his van, threw his board in his back, respect for the fiberglass, and peeled out. I wonder if he liked all the slurs we sketched on his windows with surf wax, just something to remember us by. A couple of months later, the kid showed up again. We surrounded him before he even unpacked his board. Thought you learned your lesson. I had a good couple of inches and at least 40 pounds on the kid, so I used it to my advantage and leaned into his face. I did. He smiled cocksure, his weird-colored eyes laughing at us. I'm just here to watch. We all exchanged confused looks. Oh, not you guys. I'm watching them. He pointed down the beach where a large barge floated in the surf, covered in concrete pylons that looked like a bunch of stubby jumping jacks the size of a small car. We hadn't even noticed it rolling in. Oh, my God, a wave break. No. We blocked the city's every effort. No way this was happening. The guys all started yelling, but I noticed a work crew on the shore and rushed over to confront them. Heads would roll. As I approached the crew, the guy in charge seemed to realize I was barreling down on him with a whole lot of anger and influence. He moved to meet me, stupid-looking protective goggles taking up half his face, a thick stack of official papers clutching his fist. What the hell are you doing? I shouted. You don't have authorization to do this. Actually, I do, sir. He waved his Army Corps of Engineers lanyard in my face. The lack of erosion protection has been deemed a risk to Camp Pendleton and an ecological hazard to the marine wildlife. This artificial reef we're putting in will help break up the wave erosion and create a marine preserve. He waved the permits under my nose. The crew chief's radio squawked, ready, sir. Make it so, Miguel. Wait, Pendleton's south of here. It's not at risk. It will ruin the beach. By now, the other guys and a dozen other locals had crowded around, all wanting answers. We watched in horror as the pylons spilled into the water, our water. Don't worry, sir. I'm sure there are other beaches that will accept your kind. The crew chief smiled, pulled off his goggles. Violet eyes stared back. Yes.
Hey, thank you, Meg. So what inspired, what brought around this the story?
Actually, I just happened to run across a news article about these very upper-income guys in California who do this. They will slash people's tires, and they will bully, and they act, you know, like they're on the playground. And it sort of, so it just, the more I thought about it, the more I thought, this would be a great story.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, you come across stories about that, you know, in articles in Hawaii and stuff about how people will have this turf-surf kind of war thing. And it's so bizarre because you don't really think of surfers that way. But, I mean,
yeah,
that's so not – yeah, that's so not chill.
Right.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Our next writer up is Nick Corpon. Nick has written several books, including Soul Standard, coming up in 2016, and Stay God, Sweet Angel. His short fiction can be found in the collection Bar Scars, published by Snubnose Press, Hoods, Hot Rods, and Hellcats, Dark Corners, Crime Factory, and The New Black. He lives in Baltimore and has nearly as many tattoos as Dave Navarro, but, like, way less STDs. Nick Corpon.
I don't even know how to respond to that. This is a short called Eucharist. I flaked rust off the mailbox door and pressed it between my fingers until it was soft as a fresh scab on my daughter's name. Wayne shuffled down the driveway, the gravel flying like epithets, and nudged my elbow. He smelled like the background of a Tom Waits song. "It's getting late," he said. Footprints tracked through the frozen grass, the frost silvering the dirt patches. "It's Christmas Eve." He shrugged and snuffed hard. "Come on back to the house." Dried soil splotches on his nose. I thought of a pig snout. His lips were like rice paper ringed with foil burns. I wanted to touch them, to absorb them, but kept my hands on my bare thighs. "There's no light in the house," I said. He only scratched his crotch and then turned away. In the living room window, shadows moved like languid wraiths. The ground vibrated, and I listened for long minutes for a train whistle that never came, only the wind blowing over my ears like the top of a cracked milk jug. It sounded like her cries. I felt my communion dress, the one that I'd hemmed up for her, flutter around me. I placed the rust on my tongue and let it dissolve, and it tasted of blood. The end.
Holy shit, nicely done.
It's a really good one.
I love the line, "He smelled like the background of a Tom Waits song."
Yeah.
I told that to one of my friends. That's where the story came from.
Really? That's terrific. What? So this piece, you know, the question I've been asking, is this standalone, or is it something larger, or is it something that was larger that you cut down?
No, it just, I used to work at a tattoo shop, and when it was pretty dead there, all we would do is insult each other to keep ourselves occupied, and I told one of the guys he smelled like the background of a Tom Waits song, and just kind of went on from there.
That's great. Thank you. So our last reader for this evening spent the day at home resting his instrument and also his voice. Art Taylor has won 2 Agathas, the Anthony, the McCavity Award, and 3 consecutive Derringers for his short fiction. His stories have appeared frequently in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, and his novel and stories, On the Road with Del and Luis, was published last fall by Henry Press. He's an associate professor of English at George Mason University, home of the 2006 Final Four contenders, and he contributes frequently to the Washington Post, the Washington Independent Review of Books, and Mystery Scene Magazine. Art Taylor.
Thank you so much, Ed. This story was originally published in the anthology One Paycheck Away, published by Main Street Rag Press. The title is The Blanketing Snow, and it's subtitled A Fairy Tale Revisited. After midnight, the snow began to fall more heavily, puffs of white wonder glistening in the bright night sky. Lying awake in the bed beside him, she couldn't see the snow, but she could imagine it clinging fast to the roof, burrowing into the shingles cracks, weighing down the tender branches of the sapling just off the front steps, smothering the yard. The weatherman on the news had promised 6 to 9 inches by morning, 9 to 12 by early afternoon, and the drift, she knew, would be even deeper in the woods surrounding the house. No, she couldn't see the snow, but from the cold air straining through the caulking around the windowsills, she felt certain it was falling faster and that the wind had grown more brisk. Their home was no longer tight. "This means we can get new windows soon," he whispered, as if reading her mind. She wasn't certain whether to be comforted or not by the fact that he, too, was still awake. The news had talked about the mounting layoffs as well, the shrinking economy. Construction had already slowed down. Carpenters were hardly in high demand, and she knew he was sometimes careless, never the best worker on the site. Who knew how long it would be before he was hired on again. The cold air blew accusingly around the windowsill by the bed. He had patched it up, but new windows were needed. Sills and sashes didn't come cheap, and turning up the heat didn't help. The old boiler was far from efficient, and they couldn't afford to raise the temperature. Putting food on the table came first. The only way to afford the sashes and sills and higher energy bills was to put less food on the table, and there was barely enough bread to go around now. Tomorrow would be a busy day. At 7, they planned to pull back the bed covers in the next room, pile them into some crumpled semblance of anguish and loss. Her husband would rush into the snow while she called the neighbors, the nearest of them a mile down the road. The house would soon be filled with people from this remote corner of the country while police led others in a search of the woods. And what would she say when it was over? They must have seen the snow from their window, run out to play in it. That's why they were dressed so meagerly, wasn't it? No, the door wouldn't lock. The key had broken off in it last week. No one ever comes out here. We didn't see a rush to fix it. We never heard them leave. She remembered watching her husband breaking the key in the door when the forecast called for snow. He'd used pliers to arrange the alibi, control where the key broke so that he could fix it himself later. No use buying new parts. Every penny counts, he'd told her, and he'd assumed as well that the neighbors would chip in for the funerals. The wind stalked once more around the fissured sill, searching out her hair and her neck, crowding against the blanket she was suddenly embarrassed to have wrapped around her. Had it been only an hour since they'd awakened the twins to see the blizzard? Sleepy eyes had grown wide at the sight of it. Outside, after dark, hide and seek in the snow, a special night, their faces were aglow with wonder. And they were still out there now, hiding behind some fallen tree or huddled in some shallow ditch amongst a flurry of silly giggles as the air thickened with falling flakes and the snow overwhelmed the land. No bread crust to cover here, only her husband's purposeful, hurrying strides and her own only faintly faltering footprints. But what frigid blast could muffle the radiant mirth of her children calling after her, perhaps still calling merrily into the emptiness? We're ready. Come find us. Come find us now.
Wow. That's great art.
That's powerful.
Yeah. What led to this story? Where did the inspiration come from?
It was kind of an experiment. This is an older story, and I just came back up against it. But it was mainly sort of an exercise to revisit a fairy tale. I was reading some of Angela Carter's stories in The Bloody Chamber, and which are like fresh takes on fairy tales. And I wanted to try one myself, so I picked Hansel and Gretel and thought about, you know, which is already a dark story, and thought about looking at it from the perspective, a different perspective. And so that was where some of the idea came from.
Now, how did you decide, did you know exactly where to end it, you know, from the start, or was it something that you had to figure out a few times?
Endings are the hardest thing for me, and even after I've written a story, I feel like that's the thing I tinker with the most. Make an ending that hopefully resonates somehow with the reader, and something that's you know, what you're trying to do is build toward both something that's unexpected, I hope, and something that seems to, you know, to have a sense of final statement about it. So this one had I wanted to twist up, even as there's another level to it. That's the biggest work I do is on the ending of any story.
Mm. Yeah, no, it definitely will resonate. It's haunting, you asshole. That's going to stick on the great way. But that was terrific. Thanks to everyone for reading tonight. And thanks especially to Pam Sack for having us. And for being super terrific place for crime fiction, especially more enthusiasts to gather. As Pam said, and I said at the beginning, we'll take some phone calls now. If you have any questions for any of the writers tonight, the number to call in is 347-633-9609. Again, 347-633-9609. And since we have all the writers, with the exception of, I believe, Kara still on the phone, if you guys have any questions to ask each other, let's start the conversation. Just introduce yourself first, so we know who's talking.
Hello.
And no radio silence, please.
Well, let's go ahead and see if anyone's calling in. I'm amazed with all of the authors tonight that you've chosen to be on the show with you, Ed. I loved Art's story. It was just amazing. But I want to go to Josh. Josh, are you still with us?
I am, Pam.
Hi, Josh. I love the way you tell a story. Just have been introduced to you, to all of you, well, except for Steve and Nick, and of course I know Ed. Can you tell me a little bit more about your writing history, please?
Well, it's getting to be kind of a long history, Pam. I published in Ellery Queens when I was 16 years old, and I've been pissed off for almost 50 years now that a guy named James Yaffe, who wrote the Mom stories, was only 15 when he got published in Queens. So it makes me the second youngest. It's like winning a silver medal at the
there,
Olympics.
And there's no do-over on that, Josh. You know,
no,
that's the pinnacle,
cannot get younger.
Right?
But
yeah.
I've been writing for Queens and Hitchcock's and a bunch of other places, almost exclusively short stories, for pretty close to 50 years now.
Well, your reading skills are just terrific. You really painted a visual with that read for me. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it very, very much.
Thank you. I appreciate the compliment. It's fun to read.
It's a lot of fun. Do you know David Gates, who writes pretty much for those magazines too? David Edgley Gates?
I know his work. I haven't met him.
Yeah, he's a great guy, and he's a friend and has been on the show too. And he reads and writes with the same passion that you have, which means you quickly shoot up the top of the list to one of my favorites. So I want to thank you for a really good experience.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Art Taylor. Will you tell me a little bit about your writing history too? I love the way you tell a story. I have to tell you that I live in Southwest Florida, so I don't live in the South, as you well know. But you remind me of those old storytelling Southern families. Did you perchance grow up in one of those families?
I take very seriously the idea of a Southern literary tradition. Mm-hmm. I don't know that my immediate family were storytellers themselves, but we always valued good books, good stories. My mom read to me from the time I was very young, and we're now passing that along to our son, Tara and I, mm-hmm. who read first, traded off midway.
Right.
On that, so she's upstairs taking care of him. But I think that idea of books being important, of stories being important, is something that has certainly informed my work from the very beginning. But I do, I listen to the cadences of Southern storytellers as part of my tradition, and then of course, as Josh and I have talked, we're good friends as well. Ellery Queen was such a formative literary influence as well. I was a reader from very young, and so the mystery storytelling, mystery fiction has been imbued in me from the beginning. So yeah, it's I don't know. Maybe I got it honest. I don't know.
So you guys, I read this in an interview, I think, or a post that Josh wrote. This is Ed, by the way. But you guys are co-writing a story together too, aren't you?
We've done some talking about it. Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about it. I've stalled a little bit on my end, unfortunately, not in thinking about it, but in terms of actually getting anything back to Josh. But Josh has a great history of partnerships like that. Josh, you want to talk about that?
Well, back in the 80s, I started working on what I thought would be a collection of short stories called Partners in Crime. And it was going to be 15, 20 stories, each written by two people. And in each case, one of the two would be me. And the stories got written, but all of them were published individually in Queens and Hitchcock's and other places. But the collection never happened. But there's now this year some interest in putting the book out from the same people who just did The Tree of Life, the collection of my Mahbub Chaudhry stories that originally appeared in Queens. So I thought rather than just putting out a book of 30-year-old stories, I should have some new ones too. And Art and I are discussing working on one together. I just finished one with a Dutch writer that will be in Queens later on this year. A couple of other people and I are tossing some ideas around. And I'm hoping this book will finally see the light of print all these years down the road.
Actually, one of the people, are you and Meg working on something too?
We have not started working on something, but we have had a conversation that included, gee, maybe we should. And if we do, she will be, of all the collaborators I've ever worked with, the one with the best hair.
Thank you.
Gee, Meg, what a thing get your name out there on, right?
Exactly.
You're the author with the best hair. This is the new marketing scheme.
Hey,
thought up by Josh.
Makes me memorable.
That's right.
Well, I hope you're not offended, Art, by that.
No, not at all.
I mean, he's right there.
I hope my wife and daughter are not offended by that. I did stories for each of them.
So I have a question for the guys who, the writers here who primarily do novels, you know, Alan, Meredith, and Dana. You know, what's the, for you guys, I mean, do you prefer novels, or is that just or do you find, you know, I mean, is it fun to write short stories, or is it kind of agonizing?
Oh, it's agonizing. This is Alan. It's agonizing. I think, of course, writing a novel is agonizing, too. I think in longer story arcs. But the last couple of years, I started writing shorter fiction, so I think I'm slowly retraining my brain a little bit.
This is Meredith. I agree with Alan, actually. I find writing a short story sometimes takes me as long as a novel. I mean, not that I'm working on it constantly, that would be awful, but no, but I have to put it down because I often get stuck and I realize like, oh, I had this great idea and then I don't know what to do with it. So I find it almost easier to write a novel.
What about
you,
Dan?
I find short stories are really hard to write because if I like the character in a situation, like Alan mentioned, I tend to start to think of it as a longer form. I can write flash pieces because they're like little snapshots. I can get away with that, but short stories are really hard for me.
You know, one question I had for two writers, for both Nick and Steve, do you guys, you know, there's been a huge surge in the neo-noir movement, and you both are sort of put into that. Do you like that, or do you find it confining?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't really know what I write, to be honest. I just try to write whatever interests me, I guess, and I think I've consciously made an effort to not write things that are quite so bitter and dour and dark because it's just fucking depressing all the time. but even then, I just sent a novel to someone and I was like, yeah, you know, I think it's actually pretty broad. It's good. But, you know, there's some double crossing and they plot to kill a sheriff and a mom tries to kill her son. But, it's, you know, it's bright and happy and stuff. There's some jokes. I don't mean to write dark stuff. It's just the way that it kind of ends up going.
What about you, Steve, if you're still on the line?
Yeah, I don't know what that means. I hear people say neo-noir all the time or this genre or that genre. I think most of us write the stories that we want to tell, and whatever gets classified in, that's really the business of the people who are trying to sell the stories. I don't really have any stake in that. I've got characters that I want to develop, stories that I want to get across, themes that I'd like to weave throughout the story. You know, I don't give a shit whether it's called neo-noir or romance. You know, it doesn't matter to me. Hopefully it's got elements of all sorts of things in it.
I have a question for Nick.
I'd also like to put on the record that Steve writes romance novels now.
There you go.
I'm updating his Wikipedia page right now.
There you go. Hey, Nick, I have a question for you. You read the shortest piece tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Do you enjoy doing flash or short stories, or what is your preference for where your words go?
Like Dana and Meredith were saying, I actually prefer novels. This was a really, mm-hmm. really short piece that I wrote, I don't know, probably 5 or 6 years ago, but I knew that we were doing short stuff, so I actually added 6 or 7 sentences to it, so it wouldn't be so incredibly short. But I used to write a lot of short stories, and my brain just doesn't seem to function that way anymore. It's always looking for, like, longer arcs and, you know, extrapolations of character and things like that. And I guess the really, really short flash pieces are okay if I have an idea, but they just, I don't know, they don't come to me like they used to.
Well,
right now,
that may be a sign of maturity, if that's the case. You know, that may be the sign of your writing maturity, but I don't know. I still think that if you write a really good piece of flash, if you're under 1,000 words, to me, that's impressive. To tell a story in 1,000 words, I'm blown away by it. I think all of you did a really great job, by the way. Very enjoyable. Very enjoyable for me to listen to it. Ed, back to you.
Okay. I had a question for Meg about, you know, I guess you really. When did you publish your first story?
That's probably been about maybe 3 years ago.
Two to three,
somewhere in there. It's sort of a toss up because the one I was supposed to have published first ended up being pirated from the site itself, from the publisher. and so I don't know whether to actually call that my first piece or not now, because then it didn't come out in the magazine. So,
wow.
So I guess 3 years approximately. And before that, it was primarily academic writing.
Now, you, you said, I wasn't kidding in your intro when I said you were a cultural anthropologist. What was your focus on that, and how is that tied into your writing?
Yeah, so I'm a cultural anthropologist who focuses on violence and human rights in East Africa, primarily, also Central and Southern a bit, but really primarily East Africa. And so I've lived overseas for a good portion of my life, working in very difficult areas and with very difficult issues as well, with obviously a lot of violence since that's my topic. It certainly has influenced the way that I view the world, and it has certainly influenced the types of stories I write, and I like to think that a lot of my stories, even if they do go darker, that there is a little bit of hope there too, because I think that even in the worst situations, it's pretty remarkable. The human spirit is something to be admired.
Well, congratulations on that, Meg.
Thank you.
Yeah, one last thing I wanted to do, because I always think we should talk more about other writers' works than our own, to an extent. I mean, we all have to kind of whore ourselves out. But what I'd like everybody to kind of go through and name a writer now they're reading or someone they've recently read whose work they like a lot. I'll go in the order that we read tonight. So, Alan.
Yeah, I just read a great book. It was called A Head Full of Ghosts by Paul Tremblay. And I guess it skews more towards horror, but I thought it was terrific. So that's my recommendation.
All right. Josh?
I've actually been reading a lot of Dutch and Belgian fiction lately, and there are a couple of writers who, you know, now that the Scandinavian wave has slowed down a little bit, I hope the next wave will be a Dutch and Belgian wave, so that people who don't read Dutch will get a chance to be exposed to people like Bob van Leerhoven and Bram de Hauk and Hilde van der Meeren and my co-writer on Styx, Bavo Doge. These are just some great writers, René Appel and Tessa DeLow. They're doing work that I think America would really like.
Meredith?
I have been on an awards committee, so I actually can't say what I've been writing or what I liked until the announcement this week.
Wow.
I'll just leave it at that.
How many books have you been reading?
Can we ask what awards your committee you're on? For whom?
Lee Edgars.
Congratulations. Oh, cool. How fun.
Oh, it was delightful. I think I received about 500.
Wow.
So, yeah. It's fantastic. I have to say that the short story is very healthy.
Yeah.
That's good to know. That's really good to know. Good, good.
Yeah.
Well, you'll have to come back and talk to us about the Edgars, okay?
Okay.
All right.
Great, Steve?
Yeah, since we're mentioning, mystery and romance and all that sort of thing, I want to make sure I mention Holly West's book. If you follow the Do Some Damage blog, you probably already know Holly West's books, but she writes the Mistress series and a number of other things. But it's great because it's historical fiction, not really romance, but it's historical fiction, it's mystery, it's fantastic, and not the sort of thing that I'm used to reading, but I am used to reading good books, so it fits in there. And another one that's kind of mixes in a number of different things is Kieran Shea's Coco series, Coco the Mighty, Coco Takes a Holiday, that sort of thing, which is noir and sci-fi and all that sort of thing. It's a cross-genre because that gives Crime Theory Magazine's John Jordan an aneurysm. But, you want a book that mixes in all sorts of things. And I think that those two, Holly West and Kieran Shea, are great examples of just, fantastic writing that just works in all these sorts of places where most bookstores, need to buy a number of copies just so they can shelf it in different areas of the bookstore.
Interesting.
The Coco series, that's just waiting to be made into a movie. It's so good.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so visually well told. Just a terrific, terrific writer. Dana?
It's hard to pick one, but if I had to pick one, I would have to say right now it's Adrian McKinty. I'm four books in his series that takes place during the Troubles about a Catholic cop working in Protestant Northern Ireland during all the IRA issues. And they're wonderful books. Adrian's a wonderful writer, and the books themselves, he does a great job of putting you back in that period and trying to, it's very difficult, I think, for people in the United States to have an idea of what it must have been like to live in Ireland during this period of time when you had to go out and check under your car every day before you left to see if there was a bomb under. And he does such a great job of putting you in that mindset.
Wow.
Okay. Meg?
If I had to say one person lately that I've just enjoyed so much, it's Dion Mayer's work. And he is he's Afrikaner, and so he's South African, and he writes about a South African police detective named Benny. And he's fantastic with place, and he also is really good at getting race in there and sort of just all the different dynamics and class in South Africa, which is such a complex mixture anyway. I discovered him a number of years ago. He was actually up for an Edgar. So I read 13 Hours, which if you've never read, it's a pulse-pounding book. And so he's a big favorite, especially of late.
Nick?
I've been catching up finally. So I read a couple Tom Franklin books, and they were amazing. I finally read Richard Price and wondered why I'd been waiting so long. And I really enjoyed Chris Urban's collection, Safe Inside the Violence, and Gabino Iglesias's Zero Saints.
And Pam, Chris is actually coming up, right? Isn't he on your January schedule?
Yes, he is.
Oh, great.
I can't wait to talk to him. It's going to be fun. next week.
Yeah. He's a cool guy. He's a New England Patriots fan, but besides that.
He's a really cool guy.
He's a Bengals fan.
Yeah. And Art.
Yeah, what's funny is Nick stole my thunder. I was going to mention Safe Inside the Violence as well, Chris Irvin's book.
A great book. Yeah.
It really is. You know, I read a lot of short stories, so some of the stuff I read is in magazines and things, but that was a collection that I just recently read. I'm so bad. If I'm at a cocktail party and somebody says, so what are you reading these days? Even if I'd read something that afternoon, my mind goes completely blank. So, you know, but that's one that stood out to me. And another of his buddies, Angel Louise Colon, I hope I'm pronouncing the name correctly, Fury of Blackie Jaguar, was a tremendously
fun book. Oh, my God, that's a great book, isn't it? It's a
fantastic
book.
Yeah,
book.
So,
Angel was just on. He's going to also host one of the he's hosting our Dames in the Dark show. So,
you'll
hear more from him. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's
a
terrific
writer. But those were a couple
of
books that were – that were on my nightstand, just recently, and certainly ones that left an impact on me. So fine work there.
And I want to play. I'm going to give an answer. I have been reading I'm waiting for his new book to come out, but I've been reading the second book by a writer named J.J. Hensley, who's out of
J.J. is a great guy. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great guy, good writer, and his novels are so well set up and plotted and written. They're just terrific. So I really like the work he's done. And his new book's coming out, I think it may be already up for pre-order. I'm not sure, but it's
which one?
It's coming soon for sure.
Which one? I've read all his books. I read all of his books ahead of time. So JJ is a really talented writer. Do you know the story of how he started writing? Ed, by the way, he and his wife used to ride to work together, and it was a pretty long commute, and so they listened to audiobooks, and which is really fascinating to me, how you get something different from a story when you listen to audiobooks. And he said, oh my God, you know, that sounds so stupid. I would never do that, or that doesn't sound realistic to me. And his wife issued him a throwdown and said, well, go write your own book then. And he did. And, of course, his first book was up for Best First Novel for ITW. Mm-hmm. JJ's a great guy. He's been a guest on my show, and I hope to have him on now. I've read all his work. He's a really very talented guy. And you, Ed Amar, have been a guest in this network also. You've got a couple of great books out right now, I'll Sleep When You're Dead and You're As Good As Dead. You're working on the third book. When do you anticipate we might see that?
Well, I took a break from it. I'm working on something else that I'm actually going to – I usually don't like to talk about what I'm writing, but I'm going to talk about it in my Thursday column for The Independent that – actually, Meg, Tara, and Art all write for too. But thank you for that. Thank you for saying that. Yeah, it's a departure, but it's fun. It's been really exciting. And I forgot to mention, actually echoing that, Tara wasn't here to talk about the writer. She's heard recently that she likes a lot, but it's me.
Well,
so she sent me an email asking to mention that. So you're welcome.
We'll confirm that later. Ed, you've been a terrific guest host. You're a terrific author. I know that already. I want to thank, from the network standpoint, I want to thank all of the authors who read tonight. I'm fascinated by you all. If I don't have your book yet or your stories or your work, believe me, I'm going to get it. So I may be in touch with you to find out how I get your work. I want to thank all of you for being here tonight, and I hope that you have continued success, all of you. And, Ed, let's do this again sometime soon, okay?
No, thanks for having us. It was great.
And thank you very much.
You're absolutely welcome.
Thank you for being here. And thank you, listeners. Have a great night. And thanks for being here, everyone. Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're welcome. Bye.